The Afrikaner trek to America remains a trending topic across the world. We speak to U.S. intelligence analyst, retired Colonel Chris Wyatt. Welcome, Colonel.
Chris, thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be chatting with you once again. Boy, this story seems to have legs. People still want to talk about it.
Well, the second group of Afrikaners has arrived in the United States. What can you tell us about them?
Well, this was done a lot more cleverly, in my view, than the first group. Somebody leaked the information, unfortunately, and it's led to the outing of many people and death threats against their family members, their property being jeopardized back in South Africa. They've been rubbished by the president of South Africa. And as I said, some people received death threats and their families are being threatened in South Africa. This time around, it was much smarter, in my view. So a number of people came over and arrived on Friday this past week in the United States and went to their ultimate destinations. Now, because I've been honest and I've not abused anyone's trust, some of the refugees have been in touch with me, and I was aware that this group was going to land, and I announced it after they had arrived in their ultimate destination. They've arrived there, they're in temporary housing, these groups of people move into their permanent, where they're going to live for the near future, very shortly. But what's happening is that they're arriving. They put them in temporary housing because past experience with other refugees from around the world is that many of these refugees are so desperate to get out of living in camps in Kenya or in Thailand that they'll say anything. I'll go wherever you want me, only to find out later on that they have family living in Mississippi or New York or somewhere like that. And then they pick up and move and they lose their support structure because we hire non-government organizations to provide refugee services such as job assistance, translation, interpreters, housing, all the sorts of services people need when they arrive, understanding how bills work, how banks work, getting social security number. All of that is a service provided by non-government organizations funded by the U.S. government. And these people in the past have picked up and left. So what they do now is the refugee resettlement program, they put people in temporary housing when they arrive just to make sure they arrive okay, and they get acclimated for a couple weeks, and then they move them into an apartment or house that they've found that's available for them. So these folks are adjusting to the six-hour time delay, as you can imagine, a little bit of that jet lag. And they're getting accustomed. I have indications that at least one family wants to talk to me, but I haven't heard back in the last couple of days. And if they don't want to talk, that's their prerogative. I'm not here to exploit them, just to share their stories to reassure other people. And as I predicted all along in this situation, Chris, this was, that people have got wrapped around the axle. Oh, it was a charter flight. U.S. paid for a charter flight. By the way, the U.S. government didn't pay for that charter flight. A private donor paid for that entire flight, booked that aircraft and flew it to South Africa at their own expense. So the U.S. government would normally send people on commercial flights unless they're evacuating from a war zone. This isn't a war zone. So these people came on commercial flight. And I think that's why a lot of the news media were caught off guard. And they didn't even report this until the following Monday when they came back to work. Like, oh, look, refugees have gone. And ironically, I noticed a lot of the media in South Africa, the traditional media, are actually reporting my reports, which is, I think, comical. That's how disconnected they are from what's going on and desperate to tell the story. But I'm grateful that they found my news reports and they found it useful.
Chris, what about the members of the first group? Do you know how they are adapting?
Well, from what I've seen and from those I've been in touch with, they're adapting very well. The key sticking point for all of them when they arrived was, of course, getting a Social Security number. Unfortunately, in America, if you don't have a Social Security number, there's very little you can do legally. You can't get a job. You can't open a bank account. You can't purchase things. You can't sign a lease agreement for a house or an apartment. So you can't get a loan, obviously. So that's the key thing. And that was the first step for many of them in the first 2 weeks. I haven't confirmed if they've all gotten Social Security numbers that I've been in touch with, but I suspect by now they've gotten Social Security numbers. Even our least efficient government agencies manage to get things done in 2 weeks usually. So I suspect they've got their Social Security numbers. But they are adjusting well. I know that at least one location, there was a braai over the weekend. So South Africans are bringing their cultural standards to America. But, we've got like 120,000 South African citizens that live in the United States, live and work over here, many on long-term, green cards, and others also short-term farming visas, things like that. So it's not unusual to have South Africans in America. So there are people they can reach out to that have already adjusted who are actually in the States. I think they seem to be doing very well, especially kids. The kids are really adjusting well. I think the biggest astounding thing for every single family I've talked to is, where are the walls? Where's the wire, the razor wire? I can just walk around. They're just in awe that it's safe to walk around. Now, we've got dangerous places in America, urban centers, but basically speaking, most of the country is safe. You don't have to worry about people attacking you at night, coming to your property. So they're excited about that. And their kids are actually, you know, one of the groups, Yanomariki, when I interviewed them, those are pseudonyms, not actually their names. They had a place on their farm where their kids could only go from this spot to this spot, and they mark it with poles and flags to identify where they could safely be so the parents could see them so that nothing happened to them and they, you know, be killed or taken. And so here in the States, their kids go to local park and it's perfectly fine. I mean, they're old enough. They're not 6-year-olds. You know, these kids are a little bit older than that. So it's okay for them to go to the park and they're safe. So I think they're adapting very well from my perspective. But look, it's not painless. People will pine and miss home. That's where they grew up. That's in their blood. That's who they are. Everything isn't always roses. You know, things are more expensive. You have to get accustomed to that. Also, you know, we drive on the correct side of the road, not the wrong side of the road. So they have to get used to that. That's, you know, people getting on the wrong side of the car and hitting the turn indicator where they need to hit the wiper. So, but that happens to all of us when we switch back and forth between Anglophone and the rest of the world. So I think they're doing well.
Great. Now, do you know how many people in total have applied thus far for Trump's Afrikaner minority refugee program?
The only data point, thank you for pointing that out, Chris. I appreciate that because virtually no media in South Africa telling the truth. First off, in the first group of 59, it wasn't all white Afrikaners. There was a colored family in there, and they failed to report that. Not a single media outlet that I've seen in South Africa has bothered to report that, or the U.S. yet, that there was, maybe the New York Times might have mentioned it in the most recent report by John Elligan, but no one's reporting on that. They keep talking about farmers and why farmers shouldn't go, and everyone suffers from crime. In that first group, there were 59. The second group, I know the numbers, but that's not something I'm sharing because that kind of gets to the point of undermining the safety and security of people's in the program. You know, it's, as we say in the military, operational security, OPSEC. And so I think that that's important to protect the OPSEC of people so that that they don't become targets. You know, they're just other people showing up at the airport. We did see some anecdotal evidence that something strange happened in the airport. And I don't know if this was just a case of a bitter airport person working at the check-in counter or what happened. It's never happened to me in South Africa. I've always had great experience with the FlySAF Air folks, the Airlink folks, the Delta folks, the United folks, Lufthansa, Air France. I've never had a problem ever in the hundreds of times I've been in South Africa. But there was an instance of one of these families. They had packed their bags and they ensured that they were under the weight, the 23 kgs, which is your allowed on a commercial flight. And when they arrived, suddenly their bag was over limit and they were supposed to pay like $100 for the bag. And that doesn't make any sense. And they realized, they looked and they saw that someone's knee was on the scale pushing it down. So that happens in some place around the world. So just a word of advice to those coming over, just pay attention, make sure that, this could happen to anybody, anytime. I don't know that anything to do with refugees. Maybe it did, but also they were kind of, the one family is kind of being harassed a little bit by the check-in folks, which is odd. There was a U.S. embassy employee with identification that was available to make sure they got checked in, got through the check-in through security, and then until after they left in the air, there was embassy employee staying at the airport. So I think that should reassure future refugees who want to come over that you're going to have that help and escort, and it'll be nondescript. It's not like they're running around with big signs going, "We're from the U.S. embassy here to protect the refugees." So I just thought I'd share that anecdotal story.
What is the biggest piece of advice you can give those who still want to go?
Well, patience. And I realized just now, Chris, I didn't answer your last question. You asked, what's the number? We don't actually have the, I didn't answer it. Sorry. We don't actually, I got down a rabbit hole telling that story. We don't actually have a number. The only data point we have as far as how many statements of interest have been filled out is Secretary of State Marco Rubio testified before the Senate on, I think, unrelated matters. The question came up in last week. He said 70,000. Now, if that's true, that would be from May 12th when the program opened, when I was sitting at OR Tambo at Wimpy eating breakfast. That's when the program opened and I announced it, May 12th until last week. So in late May. So in just 2 weeks, 70,000 statements of interest. Now, bear in mind, that's head of household. Okay. Some of that's one person in the household. Some of that's seven people in the household. So we don't know the actual number, but that's the figure that he gave. And to me, that's a shockingly, astoundingly high number, particularly given the way the media have been rubbishing the program and politicians have been dismissing it and people have been attacked for showing any interest in the program. So your next question, what was the next one?
Actually, I want to ask you what you have made of President Cyril Ramaphosa's utterances since his return from Washington.
Well, I'm very disappointed in President Ramaphosa. I made a video before I left South Africa when I was in the Western Cape because I'd seen that Rob Herzog had made a video imploring President Trump to take some action vis-a-vis South Africa to improve the situation. I made a video imploring the South African delegation to not do certain things when they went to the U.S., including lecture Donald Trump. And that's exactly what they did. They did all the things I asked them not to do. So I'm incredibly disappointed at the actions of President Ramaphosa and also Dean McPherson from the Democratic Alliance, who cackled like a hyena when Ramaphosa told the joke about the lights being dimmed and mocking President Trump. Dean McPherson thought it was funny. To the credit of the security detail that was with President Ramaphosa and McPherson, they kept stone cold faces. And that's what Dean McPherson should have done. It was inappropriate to laugh about the torture and murder of people that is so callously dismissed. And President Ramaphosa then telling jokes about it when he was at the podium was really unfortunate. I'm very disappointed. I'd hoped that South Africa would take this seriously, but obviously the politicians in South Africa don't think that they need anything from the United States, and they can say what they want and do what they want. And they're welcome to do that. South Africa is a sovereign country. But if you think it comes without consequences, then you're delusional. And I think that the ruling government in National Unity thinks there's no consequences for their actions. And I think they're going to be sadly disappointed very soon.
Now, you and I watched that debate very, very carefully, but I have since seen some seriously distorted reports on that. Am I the only one?
When you say debate, you mean the conversation in the Oval Office we're talking about, yes? Yes, absolutely, Chris. And I've talked about this in the very beginning. First off, I cannot say that Donald Trump has never used the term white genocide, because in fact, he did use it in a Truth Social post, and he was answering a question when he was angry and he used the term. But generally speaking, he never used it previously. Ever in the past. And it was just in recent. And when he went to the Oval Office, he was set up by a South African reporter who asked the question, President Trump, do you really believe that there's a white genocide in South Africa? To which President Trump said the following, I'm not convinced of that. That's what his response was. He never used the term white genocide once in that Oval Office meeting in public. We don't know what happened behind closed doors. We weren't there. But in public, before the world's cameras, and every single media outlet and every single commentator, and indeed today, Justice Malala, with more lies, more distortions, more yellow journalism, more propaganda, lying about what Trump said. Trump never used the term genocide. The term genocide is being used by the media in South Africa and by Western media to rubbish the suffering of racial minorities in South Africa. And, you know, it's really disgusting to see this nonsense and what happened there, because they're the ones. The term white genocide, I hear from the media. Doesn't come from me. It doesn't come from reputable people in the center or on the right, by and large. It comes from the media who stoked this to undermine the true suffering of people in South Africa. And Chris, I need to make this very clear. I think we've talked about this before. This program does not exist because of a genocide. It doesn't exist because of crime. It doesn't exist because of farmers. The program that President Trump created in the 7 February executive order is very clear. It's because of unjust racial discrimination. That's the bottom line here. Racist laws, which Dan Corder dismissed with a ridiculous argument of Piers Morgan. You look like an idiot talking away that stuff. You know, it's an abomination what the press in South Africa are doing, falsehood reporting and misleading the world. Trump did not admonish, and it wasn't an ambush. I mean, this is the most comical thing. The South African government requested the meeting. Trump graciously rescheduled his calendar and made a meeting for them. And then Ramaphosa made Trump wait 30 minutes. The president of the United States was kept waiting for 30 minutes while Cyril Ramaphosa was on Africa time. Wow. And it was an ambush? It was an ambush. Was there anything that was shown in the video that didn't happen? Was it anything altered or doctored? Was it artificial? No, this is actual footage. These are actual words uttered. And if anything, Donald Trump did Julius Malema a huge favor, Chris. Not Julius Malema, excuse me. He did Cyril Ramaphosa a huge favor, because he showed footage of people who aren't in the ruling government, people who are not part of the ANC. It gave Ramaphosa the ability to distance himself from it. And then he rudely interrupted the president of the United States as a guest of the Oval Office when another South African reporter put a stage question. What will it take, President Trump, for President Ramaphosa to convince you there isn't a white genocide? And rather than let Trump answer the question, which is what should have happened, Ramaphosa said, oh, no, no, I'll take this question. I'll take this question. And then he interrupts Trump, and Trump says, okay, go ahead. So basically, Trump hands him the shovel, the spade, and Ramaphosa dug his own grave, because then he began lecturing Trump. It will take the president listening. And there you go, lecturing President Trump. There isn't a single thing that's being refuted. It's just being called an ambush. There was no ambush. They knew this was coming. And if they didn't, they're stupid. I warned them. I'm sure their advisors warned them. Whoever briefs them warned them that this was going to happen. And they had no response other than to claim that he was ambushed and that it isn't happening. It's really sad to see, Chris.
Before I forget, is there anything more to Elon Musk's departure from the White House, or was his time just up, Chris?
Yes. And I want to get to something else about a Brits attack if we can before we wrap up. But Elon Musk, I said all along that this was a temporary 120-day appointment, which the president can do under the law. a special appointment. If he goes for something beyond that, then he's going to have to go through the Senate for confirmation. And that wasn't the intent. The intent was to set up a team that can identify fraud, waste, and abuse, or just, you know, poorly spent money. And that's what they did. There's no animosity. This was always the case. And I reported that the media on the left was going to claim that there's a rift between the two of them. There's no rift, none whatsoever. The only thing that's happened here is that Elon Musk's business has been grievously harmed by people who've undermined them because their feelings are that he is finding fraud, waste, and abuse. And you have to understand that just like in South Africa, when you uncover fraud, waste, and abuse, somebody's profiting from that fraud, waste, and abuse. Somebody's getting that money. And when you take it away, their feelings are hurt. And if they're powerful, they'll try to destroy you. And that's what they try to do to Elon Musk. But the man is rich beyond imagination. They can harm his businesses, but he'll be the wealthiest man on the planet for the rest of his natural life, unless he, you know, starts going to Vegas and gambling. So there's no animosity between Trump. There's no animosity between Musk. In fact, he's going to stay on as a personal advisor in an unofficial capacity, which, by the way, President Trump, I'm available if you're looking for a personal advisor, at least on South African issues.
There was something you wanted to bring up, Chris. What was that?
Yes. So, excuse me there, Chris. I still got a little bit of the affliction I picked up in South Africa. It hasn't quite cleared. So it happens. We're humans and we're susceptible to viruses. So anyway, there was a farm attack last week in Brits. And unfortunately, it's the mother and the stepfather of a dear friend of mine. They were savagely assaulted on that farm in Brits, beaten with an antique iron, tied up. He's an elderly wheelchair-bound man, tied up. They poisoned their dogs a few days before the attack. Then they stole the tires off their bockies the next night, off their bockies so they couldn't escape or get away. And then they broke in at 2 o'clock in the morning, tied up this elderly couple, beat them with inch of his life, and then left the scene, just taking a television, and that was about it, so that it could be categorized as a house robbery. And the reason I'm mentioning this is how crime statistics are bogus in South Africa. So when the police came, I have a copy of the police report. It's reported as a house robbery. The man, they attempted to murder him, and I have the sad news to tell you today that they did murder him. He died early this morning from the grievous assault that occurred last week. So now it's a case of murder. But the police, in their crime statistics, have listed as a house robbery, not a farm murder. And this is reprehensible. This is why crime statistics in South Africa are not trustworthy and why people should look at this with a jaded eye every time you hear somebody like Dan Korter or Justice Malala or a South African politician tell you that only, or Senzo Nkunu tell you, the police commissioner, that only one white farmer is murdered. They cover this up. That doesn't make white people special. Doesn't make black people any less important. All lives matter. All murders should be addressed. All should be reported. But this is being covered up. And it's time that someone tell the truth and expose this. This is not a house robbery. At a minimum, it was aggravated assault. It was trespassing. It was a home invasion and a robbery at a minimum. And now it's a murder case.
Thank you. That was U.S. intelligence analyst, retired Colonel Chris Wyatt, speaking to BizNews. Thank you, Colonel. I'm Chris Stein.
My pleasure, Chris.
From BizNews.